Nauru has been through more dramatic economic cycles in the past 60 years than any other part of the Pacific. In the 60s, it finally got control of its lucrative phosphate industry, and by 1975, it was deemed to be the second wealthiest country in the world on a per capita basis, just behind Saudi Arabia. This money ran an airline, a shipping line, money was spent on high-rise buildings in Australia, and a musical that flopped in London, while many Nauruans got their education and their health treatment overseas, courtesy of a paternal government. But by the 1990s, that money was gone. But now Nauru is back and was welcomed into the World Bank's high-income group last year. The Australian National University's Development Policy Centre has put out a report called Riches to Rags to Riches that looks at this economic rebirth. Professor Stephen Howes told Don Wiseman there are two key factors in this rise.
The most important change is the regional processing centre. You know, based on the agreement with Australia that Nauru will house asylum seekers coming to Australia by boat. You know, we'd all known this was important for Nauru, but certainly I hadn't realised just how profitable it's been. And the other interesting thing is that, you know, most of the asylum seekers have actually left. And so you'd think that this was no longer such an important source of revenue. But in fact, it is. You know, the Australian government is basically paying Nauru to keep the camp open, I guess in case they need it in the future. So in 2019-20, revenue from the regional processing centre made up 58% of the Nauru government total revenue. 58%. And that's actually $150 million Australian dollars, which is huge. I mean, that is, you know, that's about $15,000 per Nauruan. So that itself has obviously made a massive difference to the Nauru economy. And then the other thing is fishing. And Nauru is a very small island, but has a large economic zone. And obviously as part of the Nauru agreement, and that agreement's been incredibly successful. And so in the case of Nauru has resulted in tripling of revenue, and so that was fishing licence revenue was $73 million.
So the Australian taxpayer has poured hundreds of millions of dollars over this past 9 years, haven't they, into the processing centre on Nauru.
Billions, yeah.
Yeah. And at some point they're going to stop doing that. Does Nauru then just crash back?
Right, yeah, that obviously is a risk. I mean, I think you have to give credit to the Nauru government. You know, whatever you think of that agreement, they have, you know, sort of bargained pretty hard, I think, with Australia to share in the revenue from that agreement. Because, you know, obviously Australia wants Nauru to host that processing centre, and so it's totally legitimate for Nauru to say, well, how much is it worth to you? And clearly they have been successful in extracting a lot of value from that agreement. And the second thing I'd say is that, again, whatever you think of the agreement, you know, it does have a sort of bipartisan support. It was actually, you know, Labor were involved in resuscitating it. So, you know, it's possible that Australia will just keep paying. But there is a risk that it will, you know, at least the revenue will go down, or that it might terminate altogether as it has once before. And definitely that is a big risk for Nauru. I mean, to its credit, Nauru has paid off its debt that it incurred from the larger period, earlier riches to rags story, where it basically went bankrupt. So it's paid off those debts, and it has started up a new trust fund where it is putting some of the boom in revenue that it's received. But that trust fund's still pretty small. Definitely Nauru is vulnerable because of this sort of heavy reliance on the RPC.
It's a strange thing, though, isn't it? Because this renewed wealth is on the backs of these refugees who certainly did not want to be on Nauru, and lots of people all over the place certainly didn't want them to be in Nauru. Yet the Nauruans end up becoming wealthy as a result. It's a weird situation.
Yeah, that's right. So it's controversial, the agreement, and we're certainly not endorsing it. At the same time, you know, from the perspective of Nauru, you know, for these small remote islands, they're always going to have to be opportunistic. You know, they're not going to follow a conventional development path. I mean, Nauru is never going to be a tourism magnet. It's never going to be a source of industrial production. And, you know, when Nauru hit the hard times in the 90s, tried things which it was heavily criticised for, like selling passports and becoming an offshore tax haven. And eventually it had to shut those down. So I think it's not up to Nauru. You know, it's up to Australia whether it wants to go down this route of offshore processing. I can quite understand, you know, why Nauru would take advantage of that if the opportunity is there, because it has so few opportunities. And I do think it's to its credit that it has been able to extract so much revenue from that processing centre. It's really made Australia pay for it. And I think that is another question for Australia. You know, Australia has been, we know the procurement of services around the regional processing centre has been very lax, and Australia has been criticised by the Auditor General for that. But it's interesting to see the profits of that have not only gone to the Australian contractors involved, but also to the host government. I think, for example, Nauru's done much better than Papua New Guinea. I don't think PNG was able to get anything like the revenue from its processing centre as Nauru has done.
That was ANU Professor Stephen House.